Thank you so much for coming. It's delightful to see you all here. I will be brief, but it's an honor and a pleasure to introduce my colleague Phil to you, and you're in for an extraordinary treat today. Just a few words about Phil and his career here. He's a model. There's no better one, I think, on campus now of the scholar teacher and the values that that combination represents for Swarthmore. He's been prolific and eloquent in both those areas for years, and the teaching informs the scholarship, and the scholarship is eloquently informed by the daily interactions that he has in his classes every day. Alums may also know him from as a wonderful leader of some discussion groups that have occurred around the country in New York City, for instance, where Swarthmore alums have reading groups, and they Phil will give them a syllabus, say, and they will read it and then be able to meet with him once or twice a year to discuss things like that. They often will tap many different faculty on campus to do that, not just in literature, but in other fields too. But I know Phil Weinstein is a favorite among alumni groups for guidance and a visitation. I'd like to talk briefly just about some of his publications and also the famous classes that he's taught here to give those of you who may not be familiar with these a little sense of what he's done here and is doing. He's got many publications. His first book was on the wonderful American novelist Henry James. He's worldwide known as a Faulkner expert and has actually three books on Faulkner. One of them on Faulkner and Toni Morrison, two absolutely crucial 20th century novelists. And another book, the most recent one, called Becoming Faulkner, which is a wonderful, short, insightful biography, maybe the best biography to start with if you're interested in Faulkner's life and work. And that book quite deservedly just won a prize for the best book on Southern fiction from the Society for the Study of Southern Literature this year. Phil is also very well known as a theorist and an expert on modernism and what that is and why it happened and how to understand it. And in particular, I'd like to single out a book of his called Unknowing, The Work of Modernist Fiction, which is full of insights, and they all definitely grew out of the kinds of courses that he taught here and the interactions that he had with students, as well as scholars of modernism all over the world. One of the key ideas in that book is that obviously there's a certain strain of modernism that we know that goes from the Enlightenment, that believes in knowledge and control and power and has the had the ambition in the early 20th century of remaking the self and remaking societies from top to bottom along a new kind of modernist model, and was very optimistic that human beings could be remade and reorganized in that sort of way. It was a kind of utopian dream. And those of you, of course, who remember 20th century history know that in many cases those dreams turned out to be disastrous. Phil looks at ways in which there's another strain that's very important within modernism, that is a strain of powerful skepticism and doubt and irony. And he traces the genesis and the evolution of this strain through folks like Kierkegaard and Freud and Dostoevsky in the 19th century, reacting against 19th century realism and its claims to knowledge. And then the full development of this sort of skeptical strain of modernism, what he calls unknowing, or skepticism about claims to knowledge, or what is erased or left out in those claims. He traces those through great writers of the 20th century, from Beckett and Joyce, to Proust, to Faulkner, to Garcia Marquez, and others there. And it's an absolutely wonderful intellectual guide to the last two centuries, you might say, of thought and literature there. His teaching is exemplary. He's offers some of the biggest and most popular classes in all of the humanities at Swarthmore that are filled with students reading the most difficult books imaginable, such as Remembrance of Things Past and Ulysses, hardly easy reading for Parrish Beach, and yet these classes are packed, and Phil makes these books exciting and dramatic and accessible, as well as humbling there. He's well known for incisive and eloquent lectures, and you'll get a little sample of that today, but also for his caring attention to the students and their own kind of questioning and their own growth. He's also very famous for the Modern Comparative Literature Honors Seminar, which is a small class rather than a large one, usually 12 or so students. And they meet in Professor Weinstein's wonderful, comfortable living room regularly. I'm sure that's a memory that lots of his generations of students carry with them for the rest of their lives. It's a class of very high standards, but it's also a class that is taught outside of a formal classroom in ways that many seminars used to be, but fewer so are done now. But I think what the students take away from that is not the high intellectual excitement, only the high intellectual excitement of a seminar like that, but also the sense that literature is really a conversation. It's not a class that you're meant to pass through, but a conversation for life that's meant to continue for life. And I think the setting there, as well as his wonderful hospitality, really eloquently exhibits those kinds of values there. Let's see. Just one final word about Phil's interest in Franzen. It makes sense given his powerful understanding of the development of the novel in the last two centuries that he'd be interested and become interested in one of the most important contemporary novelists, one that's all worth well worth reading. Franzen's The Corrections is about many things, but one of the things that it's about is the belief that a younger generation often has that they will correct the errors that their parents, this generation, made. And the book is both a satiric and an empathetic look at what happens when you try to live under that belief. It makes for both tragedy and comedy, as Phil will show you. Freedom also, of course, is inspired by Swarthmore and also by the larger dilemmas of American life in the present there. And it takes as a particular moment its inspiration a certain block of stone from a class, 1927, I believe it is. I might be wrong about the exact date, that says, "Use well thy freedom," on the side of Parrish there. And the book is definitely raising the question of how well are we using our freedoms there. Phil will take you through both these books and through Franzen's career and give you ways of thinking about his work, his life, and its importance that will go much more deeply than this Time magazine article did, even though it was actually a pretty good article, I thought, for making a strong case for why it's important to read Franzen now. I'm going to duck out after this introduction because I've had the pleasure of already hearing the lecture, and I've got other things I need to do this morning and this afternoon. But having heard his lecture before, which he gave as a faculty lecture to faculty students and folks from the Ville earlier this year, I can assure you that you're in for an incisive and eloquent sampling of the power of Phil's thought. So thank you, and please give a welcome to Phil Weinstein. Thanks.
Introductions like that put me in a position that's not very useful today, which is speechless. I won't do a lot of deconstructing, and I'm also not going to assume that you have a lot of familiarity already. Can you all hear me? Good, with the novels. But the life trajectory is utterly fascinating, and that's what I want to try to tease out into salience. Franzen's mesmerizing face filled the cover of the August 23rd, 2010 edition of Time magazine, tussle-headed, bespectacled, looking away from the camera, guarding his privacy. He was sporting an outdoorsy, open-necked shirt and wearing a three-day beard. This ensemble gives his face and upper body a rough-hewn, all-American look. It's at once a cautious, give-away-nothing look, and I think the look of a conqueror, a mainstream culture idol. For the past decade, ever since the publication of the National Book Award winning The Corrections, Franzen's been a prominent player on the larger cultural scene. And then his notorious flap with Oprah, I'm sure you're familiar with it, his many New Yorker pieces, and his books of essays have guaranteed that he remains emphatically visible. And then a second blockbuster novel, Freedom, 2010, gave Franzen's fame an extraordinary pitch. A number of his peers complained that the lion's share of attention devoted to Franzen distorts the picture of contemporary writing. Franzen agrees. The avalanche of attention is beyond his control, and he might have been surprised by its volume. How does an insecure, introspective child and mordantly suspicious young intellectual, a figure adamantly distrustful of popular culture and its blandishments, how does this figure become one of today's mainstream culture magnets? I want to unpack Franzen's trajectory as person and writer from his ultra-sensitive, no one understands me, Midwestern childhood, up to his spectacular ascent on the current cultural scene. This trajectory passes through Franzen's heady years at Swarthmore and his subsequent marriage to a college classmate. Both of them committed themselves, all but religiously, to the insulated apprenticeship required to write the great American novel. And within a dozen years, their joint project had run out of air, collapsing under the weight of its relentless idealism. Miserable, his marriage in ruins, Franzen managed to produce two critically acclaimed but hardly best-selling early novels. And by the mid-1990s, and halfway through his own 30s, his own most deeply held ideas about who he was as person and as writer and as citizen and as husband had become bankrupt. Increasingly depressed by the consequences of his own choices, the alienation from popular American culture that he saw as a requirement of genius, Franzen could no longer remain the person he had worked for decades to become. Throughout the mid-90s, Franzen sought to reconceive himself and his writerly stance. And he hit pay dirt with The Corrections, 2001. Several months later came the misunderstanding with Oprah. She disinvited him from her TV show after hearing of his supposed concern about the middlebrow for women only aura of her book club. After that, Franzen becomes public property. Without having passed through the experience of reading his books, thousands upon thousands of Americans felt entitled to a view of him, usually astringent. He was not forgiven for dissing Oprah. And from being relatively unknown, he became glaringly well-known. And he was now a writer whom countless readers pegged as someone they would want to figure out. No one has abetted the project of figuring him out more than Franzen himself. For the past decade, he has revealed his intimate thoughts and feelings in a stream of essays and interviews. The portrait of the writer and his novels that I'm putting forth today builds on materials that he has provided in published essays. The only secrets that are on offer today have remained hidden in plain view. Moving back and forth among the essays, I want to track both a single writer's odyssey and suggest a larger dilemma of the contemporary writer's stance toward his audience. Does one write for the mainstream or for the elite who make up high culture? Can one write successfully for both audiences at the same time? Franzen's career embodies a tension at the heart of this very American quandary. Franzen on Time. So I begin with Franzen on the cover of Time magazine. Time was the journal most admired by Earl Franzen, Jonathan's sober, unfailingly serious father. Never mind that for the Franzen offspring growing up in the 60s and 70s, three brothers, time was increasingly irrelevant to the politics and pleasures of their Vietnam and post-Vietnam worldviews. But Franson's father was a product of an older, sterner, morality-driven mid-America. And he worried over how his brilliant youngest son would go about making responsible use of his talents. One thing that responsible meant was not majoring in English at Swarthmore. Since my parents had suggested I might want to pay for college myself if I insisted on being an English major, Franson writes, I was left with German by default. So fast forward now to Franson in the mid-1990s, a twice-published novelist, if not yet a household name. The aging father has begun to envisage his youngest son as embarked on a significant writing career. And he has long known what the evidence for that significance will be. Quote, one day he would pick up the magazine, Time, and find me reviewed in it. Franson wrote this in a 1995 Harper's essay. In this essay, Franson is no longer the uneasy child registering his parents' oppressive concerns about how he's going to grow up. But he's not yet one of America's most talked about novelists. This mid-1990s Jonathan Franson is grievance-ridden. He has mentioned his father's reverence for Time in the Harper's essay in order to note that years before, the Olympian James Joyce made the cover of Time twice. I still don't know if that's true, but that's what he claims. These days, it's easy enough to find out. I just haven't. These days, Franson continues, the only two writers to appear on the cover of Time are middle brow practitioners, Scott Turow and Stephen King. Writers of popular detective fiction and horror novels, writers who give familiar pleasures to their readers, they are not the company Franson wants to keep. In the Harper's piece, focused abidingly on a frustrated young novelist's quarrel with the mainstream cultural scene in America, in that piece, Franson sees himself as ignored because his disturbing perceptions about American complacency are unwanted. I'd intended to provoke. What I got instead, he writes, was 60 reviews in a vacuum. A small and fundamentally ridiculous person. What was his St. Louis childhood like? Who were his parents, Earl and Irene Franson? Growing up in Webster Groves, a borough of St. Louis, the child Franson saw his parents early on as the problem. Of the many things I was afraid of those days, spiders, insomnia, fish hooks, school dances, hardball, heights, bees, urinals, puberty, music teachers, dogs, the school cafeteria, censure, older teenagers, jellyfish, locker rooms, boomerangs, popular girls, the high dive. I was probably most afraid of my parents. Both parents struck fear into this easily frightened child in their distinctive ways. Irene rattled him by wanting to know his feelings, insisting on intimacy. In his mid-teens, when his parents took a rare trip abroad without him, leaving him in the care of neighbors, Franson, quote, opened a letter that my mother had sent me from London. The letter began with the word dearest, which my mother never seemed to realize was a more invasive and less endearing word than dear. Even if I'd been inclined to miss her, and I wasn't, the dearest would have reminded me why I shouldn't. In a later essay, looking back at her oppressive investment in his inner life, Franson quips, whoever imagined that love your mother would make a good environmental bumper sticker obviously didn't have a mom like mine. The youngest of Irene's children, quote, I faced 9 years of being the last handy object of her maternal longings and frustrations and criticisms, and so I allied myself with my father, who was embarrassed by her emotion. I began by rolling my eyes at everything she said. Earl, at least, was inclined to leave his youngest son alone. They rarely played together. The few times he ever played catch with me, my father threw the ball like a thing he wanted to get rid of, a piece of rotten fruit. Yet Earl served well enough as the powerful engineer who helped me man the dikes against the ever-invading sea of my mother. Though only rarely physically threatening, Earl instilled abiding guilt in his son about not measuring up, not taking the rules seriously enough. My father was plagued by the suspicion that adolescents were getting away with something, that their pleasures were insufficiently trammeled by conscience and responsibility. Of himself, as the offspring of these two ethically intense parents, Franson writes, I was a small and fundamentally ridiculous person. Not accidentally, this little person's culture hero was Charles Schulz, creator of Peanuts. A cartoonist of genius, Schulz crafted images that modeled for young Franson the comedy of isolation and unsuitedness, of how, by way of Snoopy and Charlie Brown, things don't fit. One never measures up. Earl Franson, by contrast to his son, was temperamentally immune to the pleasures of humor. I never heard my father tell a joke, Franson recalls. He only ever wanted not to be a child anymore. One of Franson's most telling images of his father's gravity appears in a later essay, House for Sale. Closing this essay about selling the family home in St. Louis after his mother's death, Franson remembers a childhood trip to Disney World that his father, a stickler for fairness, had imposed on his youngest son since both older sons had been taken there before. Full of pique, hating the clothes that his mother insisted on his wearing, and steadfastly refusing the park's offered pleasures, young Franson shut down, mute. Both parents tried with increasing urgency to interest him in the blandishments of Disney World. And finally, the three of them arrived at compromise, an empty merry-go-round. And the cheerful Irene took a photo of her father and son on the bobbing horses. Gazing at this photo years later, Franson sees my father, his fingers loosely grasping a horse-impaling metal pole, gazing into the distance with a look of resignation that summarized his life. This is the image of a man afflicted with gravity, immune to flights of feeling or imagination, terminally ill-suited for the merry-go-rounds of life. And another image that registers the impact of the father's gravity, his mid-century convictions about how children are to behave, the rules they are to follow, occurs on the cover of the Corrections. Forlorn, like a little soldier consigned to suffer at a setting that others have been permitted to enjoy, the youngest Lambert son, Chip, sits at the enormous family dining table. He is next to a smiling older brother, yet he is isolated, staring into space. Huge plates of food surround him. Chip has refused to eat a vegetable dish he detests. His father will punish him by making him remain at the table until the dish gets eaten. The boy remains on the dinner table, at the dinner table, almost all night, and he never does eat that vegetable. The accomplished adult on the cover of Time, the puny child on the cover of the Corrections, indicted by authority, yet impotently resisting. Incompatible images, both true. It was in recognizing not just the pathos of the Chip figure, but the comedy of his impotence. The Schulz-like ways in which a child's defeat at the family dining table intimates an abiding battle between parents and children. It was in recognizing that Franson, the misunderstood child, would become Franson, a best-selling novelist. Abiding. The dinner table drama reveals something of the warp and woof of family life in America, its daily rhythms. There is nothing esoteric here, just what everyone knows, the material of countless TV family shows. Franson will learn to see himself as caught up in the misadventures of his ordinary American life, and he will learn to write what he sees. Combat in the Discomfort Zone. The Discomfort Zone, 2002. Franson's second volume of essays owes its title to an endlessly repeated quarrel between Earl and Irene Franson over the appropriate temperature for their home's heater air conditioner. It was one machine. In the summer, Earl likes to save money and use less electricity. Irene likes cooler air. The machine itself proposes a comfort zone between 72 and 78 degrees. And the parents tirelessly reenact the drama of discovering the appliance has been set too high or too low, and then bickering. Earl, leave the goddamn thermostat alone. Irene, Earl, I didn't touch it. Earl, you did, again. Irene, I didn't think I even moved it. I just looked at it. I didn't mean to change it. Earl, again. You monkeyed with it again. I had it set where I wanted it, and you moved it down to 70. Irene, well, if I did somehow change it, I'm sure I didn't mean to. You'd be hot, too, if you worked all day in the kitchen. Earl, all I ask at the end of a long day at work is that the temperature be set in the comfort zone. Irene, Earl, it is so hot in the kitchen. You don't know because you're never in here, but it is so hot. Earl, the low end of the comfort zone. Not even the middle, the low end. It is not too much to ask. Well, all readers of The Corrections and Freedom recognize this quarrel. It is the daily buzz, the white noise of domestic discontent, of what it is exactly that you do that I dislike, and your response to my attack, mainstream to the hilt. And I don't know any contemporary writer who captures better than Franson the sound of family squabble, the tireless duets of self-defense and attack on the other that make up the strophe and antistrophe of household discord. These are not the tragic soundings that presage divorce or departure, nor are they spousal miscommunications open to reform. Much of Franson's childhood, it seems, was immersed in the discomfort zone, until the comic Charles Schulz, latent inside him, offered not so much a way out as a way in. It took me half my life, Franson writes, to achieve seeing my parents as cartoons. And himself, no less cartoonishly, caught up alongside them. None of this seemed funny to Franson at the time. This fundamentally ridiculous child suffered from mismatched parents. He suffered no less from shyness and his unconquerable sense that others would not like him. Notwithstanding, the child he remembers was convinced of his own superior, if unrecognized, gifts. The 10-year-old Franson envisaged a coming spelling bee as generating only one halfway interesting question: who was going to come in second? Determined to win at all costs, the child knew that he nevertheless housed deep within unsuitable impulses, demonic possibilities. 1950s seriousness, as embodied in both parents' respect for social convention, posed a set of constraints that the child could negotiate when necessary, but not forever. Eventually, the gravity of his parents' mid-century world would become suffocating, and his demons would emerge. Catastrophe might occur. Franson tells of an unforgettable moment when, egged on by neighborhood girls to increasingly zany exploits, dancing and prancing, the next caper always topping the last one, the little boy played his trump card. I pull my pants down. Suddenly panicked, he leaped up, pulled his pants up, and fled. Unforgettable. It's Franson who cannot forget. I'd been granted, and had granted the neighborhood girls, a glimpse of the person I knew I was permanently in danger of becoming. He was the worst thing I'd ever seen, and I was determined not to let him out again. honors program. Such a child was likely to graduate at the top of his class. His mix of anic dispositions and self-regulating strategies manageable, if not secure. And given parents as ambitious for their children as Earl and Irene Franson, it's not surprising that their youngest son would enter Swarthmore in the fall of 1977. Ever since the development of an honors program in the 1920s, Swarthmore's honors students have been invited to see themselves as promising scholars embarking on a heroic intellectual adventure. Such students back then elected 6 double-credit, ungraded seminars, rather than the 12 single-credit courses that the less elite would take. On these seminars, they would be rigorously examined and awarded honors in the spring of their senior year. And the college chose its examiners from the faculties of highly regarded colleges and universities all over the country, signaling to the larger intellectual community that Swarthmore's best were equal to the best in America. The college beckoned. Franson heard and heeded the call. And once he was at Swarthmore, he would soon enter the honors program as a German major. His parents were not convinced of the seriousness of merely 2 seminars per semester. His mother wrote, "Dad feels your schedule is so light, he's fearing he isn't getting his," in single quotes, "money's worth," or something. The irate 20-year-old Franson, his intellectual feathers ruffled, flared back, "Perhaps I should make a few things clear that I had considered common knowledge to the 3 of us. 1, I am in the," capital letters, "honors program. In the honors program, we take seminars that require large amounts of independent reading. Each one is therefore considered the equivalent of 2 4- or 5-hour courses." The honors program, indeed. The undergraduate Franson was as humorlessly persuaded of its elite intellectual rigor as perhaps the college would have hoped he would be. The essay in the Discomfort Zone devoted to Franson's experience at Swarthmore, "The Foreign Language," pays tribute to Franson's German professor, George Avery, the only teacher who would mark Franson's development in an abiding way. Avery spurred Franson to put his best energies into the encounter with German masters, Goethe, Rilke, especially Kafka. He also awakened in his student a sense that, as Franson had glimpsed in Schultz's cartoon figures, identity is fractured, non-identical with itself. It was this other side of Avery, the fact that he so visibly had another side, that was helping me finally understand all 3 of the dimensions in Kafka, that a man could be a sweet, sympathetic, comically needy victim, and a lascivious, self-aggrandizing, grudge-bearing boor, and also, crucially, a 3rd thing, a flickering consciousness, a simultaneity of culpable urge and poignant self-reproach, a person in process. No less, the demons emerging in that terrifying childhood caper, that vignette is placed in this college-centered essay. Those demons reveal their sexual baggage more openly at this point. Though Franson's high school years occurred in the supposedly liberated 1970s, following the sex and drugs breakout of the 60s, his shyness and insecurity led to his remaining virginal and excruciatingly horny. Now, these details I have from his writings, I'm not guessing. A quoted high school conversation acknowledges that at age 18, he had not yet masturbated. The Swarthmore years were infused with sexual frustration. "I was still technically a virgin," he wrote. "I lived in daily expectation of scoring." In the midst of a series of sexual near hits, this frustrated young man met his wife-to-be. She, too, was in the honors program. In time, the 2 of them would marry, each intent on writing a great American novel. And each knew thanks not least to the canonical attitudes and examples enshrined in the honors program, the kind of novel that had to be Olympian, aloof, ironic, unforgiving, a novel that a latter-day Thomas Mann or James Joyce might have approved of. Put otherwise, a novel that subsequent students in the honors program would find on the syllabus and be taught to admire as a work of timeless genius. The idealism of his writing aspirations echoes that of his love life. Swarthmorean intensity and purity of purpose, different from his father's bourgeois gravity, but no less constraining, mark the high-minded commitment Franzen made to both the marriage project and the fiction project that he launched in the 1980s. Both would eventually collapse. The marriage was the first to go. Deploring other people had always been our sport. Why a marriage collapses is a mystery without a master key. But a reader of Franzen's essays is entitled to make educated guesses. One reason is that the young husband and his literary wife both suffered from an unsustainable sense of specialness. Each felt called to write something extraordinary. Each believed that the air they breathed in together was an air no one less gifted could share. We spent thrilling, superhuman amounts of time together, he wrote later, steadfastly deaf to friends' entreaties that marriage inside a cocoon could not prosper. We made our aloneness work for 4 years, for 5 years, for 6 years, and then when the domestic atmosphere really did begin to overheat, we fled from New York to a Spanish village where we didn't know anybody, and the villagers hardly even spoke Spanish. Undaunted, they tried further geographic, or I should perhaps say desperate, they tried further geographic remedies, living apart, living together in untried cities, San Francisco, Portland, Santa Fe, Boulder, Chicago, Albany, Syracuse. Nothing worked. Franzen remembers how several years into the marriage, he, quote, wrote poisonous Jeremiads to family members who I felt had slighted my wife. She presented me with handwritten 15 and 20 page analyses of our condition. I was putting away a bottle of Maalox every week. It was clear to me that something was terribly wrong. And what was wrong, I decided, was modern industrialized society's assault on the environment. Although this diagnosis resembles targeting Iraq as the cause of the World Trade Center debacle, they nevertheless managed to soldier on until 1993. Around Christmas time, the money ran out. We broke our leases and sold the furniture. I took the old car. She took the new laptop. I slept with other people, unthinkable and horrible and ardently wished for. Our little planet was ruined. By the later 90s, he could see how crazy it was to blame his failed marriage on the environmental crisis. But the young Franzen had been primed all through his childhood specialness and the imprimatur put on it by a Swarthmore honors degree to identify exterior troubles, national, global, capitalism fueled, as the evil in need of unmasking. Deploring other people, their lack of perfection, had always been our sport, he wrote of his rarefied marriage. It went without saying that the two of them possessed 20/20 vision and no issues to speak of. The problems to be attacked were decidedly elsewhere. And the great novels they would both write would follow seamlessly from the specialness of their gifts, education, union, and calling. Swarthmore College had put its stamp on the Olympian shape their fiction would take. By the time I was a senior, my ambition was to create literary art. I took for granted that the greatest novels were tricky in their methods, resisted casual reading, and merited sustained study. I also assumed that the highest compliment this art could be paid was to be taught in a university. One does not easily shed emotional, and artistic ideals like these. Franson and his wife invested in them as long as they could, long after they had ceased to be nourishing. Years later, in a talk delivered in Seattle, Franson spoke of the failure of his marriage. "The first thing I had to do in the early 90s was to get out of my marriage. We had teamed up when she was still 20 and I had just turned 21. Our first deep, passionate conversation was about an essay of Susan Sontag's. I was dimly aware that we were too young and inexperienced to be making a lifetime vow of monogamy, and somewhat less dimly aware that the two of us weren't really even compatible. But my literary ambition and my romantic idealism and my all too easily stimulated sense of guilt prevailed. We got married in the fall of 1982 and set about jointly working as a team to produce literary masterworks. Our plan was to work side by side as writers all our lives. It didn't seem necessary to have a fallback plan because my wife was a sophisticated and talented New Yorker who seemed bound to succeed probably long before I did. Then one afternoon in the fall of 1987, I got a call from my agent telling me that my own first novel had been sold to Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I got off the phone and reported the news to my wife, who immediately burst into tears. They were not tears of joy, and I felt very, very, very guilty. When the collapse finally arrived, a marriage came apart. And despite two earlier impressive novels, a novelist of comic genius was born. He was born by way of reconceiving his own earlier shaping ideas about himself and his vocation, born as one who managed to see the Schultzian comedy of his former identity and to see it as comedy. Status versus contract. Franson's essay, Mr. Difficult, was written in 2002, and following the immense success of The Corrections, that essay conveys his repudiation of his earlier artistic values. The handy name attached to those earlier values is William Gaddis. "It turns out," Francis now claims, "that I subscribe to two wildly different models for how fiction relates to its audience, and these polarize as status versus contract. For the status model, whose superiority he'd been taught to revere, quote, the value of any novel exists independent of whether people are able to enjoy it. Joyce, Proust, Kafka, Rilke, Mann, and Faulkner, all the writers I teach, would be representative status novelists, modernist masters studied at Swarthmore and ensconced in the pantheon of great literature. Their postmodern peers for Franson were Gaddis, Thomas Pynchon, Robert Coover, and Don DeLillo. Brilliant, devious, difficult writers. None of them gave or gives interviews. Rather, they engaged the world indirectly, caustically, through the subversive labor of their work. They tend to bemoan mainstream culture and undiscriminating readers. By contrast, the contract model sustains an unfaltering relation between writer and reader, dependent on mutual trust. On this model, the work of art is a commodity like others, and, quote, difficulty is a sign of trouble. Taken to its free market extreme, if the product is disagreeable, the reader is perfectly entitled to get rid of it and buy another. The consumer rules. Franson concludes this argument by announcing his change of allegiance. The status position is undeniably flattering to a writer's sense of importance. In my bones, though, I'm a contract kind of person. I think tensions abound in Franson's subscribing to both positions, yet trying to settle for just one of them. You can't seamlessly run with the hares of status and at the same time hunt with the hounds of contract. Your work's going to reveal fissures, stress marks, that indicate a stifled but irrepressible status writer, or it will reveal glimpses of a contract writer willing to cut corners in order to keep the reader satisfied. The put-down essay on Gaddis is charged with Francis's urge to repudiate postmodern difficulty at all costs. Quote, nurturing the hope that your marginal novel will be celebrated by the mainstream, the Cassandra-like wish that people will thank you for telling them unwelcome truths, he writes, is a ritual way of ensuring disappointment, of mortifying the flesh, of remaining at heart an angry young man. Grow up, Franson reprimands postmodern experimental novelists, most of them older than him. He accepts none of their excuses, their claims that their difficult books upset or subvert the reader. What their novels mainly do, he now insists, is put readers to sleep. Franson begs William Gaddis to reward him for investing so much time in the thicket of Gaddis's meandering prose. Hello, I'm the reader you want. If you can't even show me a good time, who else do you think is going to read you? My father's brain. Except metaphorically, Franson could know nothing about his parents' brains while they were still alive. He knew a lot about their minds, enough to suffer throughout his childhood from their different ways of being who they were and making him feel pressured or misunderstood. By contrast, My Father's Brain was published in 2001, some 5 years after Franson's father's death, and it opens in retrospect. Here's a memory. On an overcast morning in February 1996, I received in the mail from my mother in St. Louis a Valentine's package containing one pinkly romantic greeting card, 2 4-ounce Mr. Goodbars, and one copy of a neuropathologist's report on my father's brain autopsy. Who was Earl Franson, his son now wonders, since he's dead, now that his most precious organ has entered medical charts and been found mortally defective, riddled with Alzheimer's? These are questions that only memory and retrospection can pose. Franson is aware that the testimony he now gives of his father's ordeal is shaped by the distance of time. What he wanted was integral to what he was. And what I want, stories of my father's brain that are not about meat, is integral to what I choose to remember and tell. To rescue Earl Franson from the impersonal mechanics of bodily descent and annihilation, the son imbues him with will, what he wanted, now seen as inseparable from what I want as his chronicler. The report that follows draws from the parental letters Franson had received over the years. Rather than mere testimony to the parents' limitations and their son's uneasy childhood, these letters now read otherwise. Death is the mother of beauty, as Wallace Stevens wrote. It's only afterwards that the lyrical shows itself. And Franson sees his parents now as he could not see them while they were still alive and while he was still young. Their banality is transfigured by the passage of time. Here's Irene writing her son some of the bad news. I'm relieved to have Dad started on his radiation therapy for a manageable cancer of the prostate, and it forces him to get out of the house every day, inserted here a smiley face. A big plus. He got to the point where he was so nervous, so worried, so depressed, I knew he had to make some decision. Actually, being so sedentary now, content to do nothing, he has had too much time to worry and think about himself. He needs distractions. More and more, I feel the greatest attributes anyone can have are, one, a positive attitude, and two, a sense of humor. Wish Dad had them. Irene's pieties and concerns radiate both blindness and pathos. Immersed in her husband's undiagnosed descent, she lacks, as all present experience lacks, the illuminating knowledge that comes later, Earl is not nervous. Distractions will not save him. The positive attitude and sense of humor that Irene earnestly rates as enablers of health appear comically inadequate to the crisis her husband is undergoing. As the survivor, Franson makes these testimonial letters register an almost Proustian sense of the limitations of present time understanding. Was blind, but now I see. The word love punctuates this essay, and the son sees how love is at once all important and irrelevant to what is happening. Another memory. I remember remembering my father in bed, my mother sitting beside it, me standing near the door. We've been having an anguished family conversation, possibly about where to move my father after his discharge from the hospital. It's a conversation that my father, to the extent that he can follow it, is hating. Finally, he cries out with passionate emphasis, as if he's had enough of all the nonsense, "I have always loved your mother, always." And my mother buries her face in her hands and sobs. Half of this essay is devoted to a description of Alzheimer's itself, insofar as a layman like Franson could understand the mechanics of the disease. Such impersonal perspective silhouettes the personal narrative being recorded, that the father's brain is not just meat, that the scientific events taking place enact at the same time a specific person's desire to shape his exit, make it coherent with the life he has led. No less, Franson grasps that the novelist inside him is composing these materials of memory. Franson even grasps that memory itself is a novelistic confection, crafted out of bits of recalled information. The brain automatically massages these bits into shapely schemas. Another way to say this is that my father's brain reveals Franson's newfound capacity to revisit home dramas of the past and to find his mother, his father, and himself as intricately human players, agents, not just victims, in that drama. The portrait of Alfred Lambert in The Corrections, that's the father, is supremely indebted to such revisiting, and it required the astonishing emotional work Franson undertook in writing The Corrections to make this moving essay possible. No less, House for Sale and Meet Me in St. Louis grasp their specific events, sale of the family home, later return to the family home, as saturated in a larger emotional and temporal field. The home that suffocated the child now reveals what it also was invisibly all during those childhood years. The house had been my mother's novel, the concrete story she told about herself. The house he suffered in, he now sees as his mother's cocoon-like sanctuary of sense, the narrative she used to understand her life. We could hardly be further from the alienated houses and homes that dot Franson's first two novels, spaces that Franson's caustic prose works to render absurd, uninhabitable by readers. Meet Me in St. Louis carries these Proustian insights further. Not only can Franson now see, too late, what mere objects actually meant in his parents' emotional relation to them, he also sees how his later post-corrections return to St. Louis, crowds gathering, cameras shooting, every encounter falsified by the TV script to be imposed on it. He can see how this travesties the realities of his childhood experience. He's being relentlessly turned into material for the TV show to be produced. The only saving grace is he knows this. Part of me is imagining how this will play on TV as schmaltz. The essay ends with his discovery of a tiny dish in the refrigerator containing a bite of peas. Looking at it after her death, I was forced to imagine my mother alone in the house and willing herself to eat a bite of something, anything, a bite of peas, finding herself unable to. With her usual frugality and optimism, she'd put the dish in the refrigerator in case her appetite returned. Well, need it be said that this is writing as recovery, not writing as attack. Franzen is as dedicated here to capturing the common drama of a parent's descent and death, a drama no reader is unfamiliar with, as he was earlier focused on weaning his readers away from familiar emotional sequences. The Franzen who emerges in The Corrections and Freedom is a time writer, one who looks back luminously rather than looking forward catastrophically. What he sees on looking back can be laugh out loud funny, or it may break your heart. Becoming Jonathan Franzen, he's the 51-year-old Olympian writer on the cover of Time magazine, adequate to himself, needing no one. He's no less the fundamentally ridiculous person of his childhood, insecure, misunderstood. This little boy and the young adult he becomes at Swarthmore failed to score, as dramatically as the figure on the cover has won all the prizes. In between is an angry young man dedicated to an emotional and artistic pathway whose elitist isolation dooms it to failure. He pursues these ideals as long as he can, straining, eventually ruining his marriage. He publishes two difficult alienated novels, both premised on the idea that America is hopelessly blind to the damage wrought by its capitalist greed. Why is everyone else so stupid? Then, his back to the wall, he begins to grasp the sources of his own unhappiness. That stupidity starts with himself, with his projects, with his relation to the world. And a new Franzen appears in time, writing two masterpieces, I think, and revisiting by way of intermittent essays his own life story, and for the last year, and 2 years ago, revisiting The Corrections for a long-term HBO series. Franzen the Loner has told us in great detail how he had to dismantle his computer so that it would stop receiving all those unwanted calls from the ambient culture, would stop so that at last he could remount his own imagination and find coiled there waiting for him once the noise died down, the two big novels that have made him famous. The Loner Franzen is also the birder Franzen. He travels across the globe as a bird watcher. Whatever else that signifies, it testifies to a desire to escape human company, to leave New York, to exit for a while from the comedy of social performance. Birding may best embody Franzen's idea of how to be alone. And yet Franzen, the anonymous global wanderer, is a very visible New Yorker. He writes regularly for the New Yorker. He gives interviews. We have this vignette of the dismantled computer only because he's passed it on to us. His desire to reach out to his readership equals, if it does not trump, his concern to remain invisible. His Freedom website has an enormous number of hits. His Facebook has thousands of followers, a dashing photo of himself. He's been invited to the White House and met President Obama. So willing is he to share his intimate thoughts and feelings with his fans in popular culture that he has proclaimed publicly enough for it to be emblazoned in bold letters on his website that shame made it impossible for me to write for a decade. Shame? Or is such a proclamation of shame in itself closer to shameless? Franzen is immersed to the hilt in the mainstream culture he so long despised. That he didn't plan to exit soon from it is revealed from his having agreed to screenwrite the HBO production of The Corrections. But the status writer in Franzen has not disappeared. He seems to have treasured most of all his friendship with the high Mandarin writer David Foster Wallace, whose suicide Franzen has lamented in print, lamented so insistently as maybe to imply to his readers, yes, I'm the contract writer you care for and trust, but no less, just as important, I am the soulmate of David Foster Wallace, the nonpareil genius. Franzen continues to bristle with contradictory leanings. His status past messing with his contract claims. And these are only underscored by HBO's decision a year ago to cancel their commitment to the corrections, despite a fortune spent and a cast and a staff to die for. Even for someone with Franzen's gifts, attempting to fuse the complexity of that postmodern novel with the mainstream appeal of a TV series must have carried a risk too large for the money men. And freed from the TV contract, Franzen is now completing a book-length translation of the, quote, untranslatable, that's his word, essays of the early 20th century Austrian intellectual Karl Kraus. Well, could any project centering on Krauss's footnotes and Krauss's scathing indictment of modern technology differ more provocatively from writing a mass market TV adaptation of the corrections? Where he goes next, as he attempts, and maybe impossibly, to straddle high culture and mainstream culture, is an open and, I think, intriguing question. Thank you.